Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, hosted by Dr. Thomas Führinger-Kuhn. Welcome to today's episode of Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle. Innovation isn't just about ideas, it's about mindset. And today, we've got the perfect guest to help you unlock your creative potential. My today's guest is an innovation strategist, keynote speaker, artist, performer, and author who helps tech leaders and companies innovate on demand with her Create the Impossible framework, which is trusted by Meta, Google, Uber, Salesforce, and many more. She's worked with UX researchers and designers to enhance communication, develop innovation strategies, and help teams spread insights throughout their organizations. With a background in improv and theater, she knows that great innovation and great communication is all about engagement, adaptability, and creating experiences. In this episode, we'll explore how to bake innovation into your company culture and how to develop what my guest calls new muscles for communication. The results? Boosted job satisfaction, enhanced team communication, and a newfound ability to tackle seemingly impossible challenges. In this episode, we provide you with practical examples to become better communicators, which will help you immediately to spread your UX insights into the organization. We'll dive into the Communications for Influence and Impact program, packed with practical exercises and real-world case studies to help you become a better communicator, especially when working with non-UX folks and stakeholders coming from other parts of your organization. And because my guest believes learning should be interactive, we're even going to play a few little games right here on the podcast. But now, happy listening.
We thank our sponsor, Codeword Customer Consulting GmbH, your coaching partner in the ever-evolving landscape of UX leadership. Are you a UX professional seeking to level up your career? Then let's get in touch for one-on-one mentoring or individual CV and portfolio reviews. Find our contact details in the show notes. We'd love to hear from you today.
Welcome to Lead UX, the User Experience Leadership Circle, your compass for navigating the ever-evolving landscape of UX maturity in organizations and UX team leadership. My guest today is Melissa Dinwiddie. Melissa is an innovation strategist, keynote speaker, artist, performer, and author, and she helps tech leaders and companies to innovate on demand with her Create the Impossible framework. This framework is trusted by Meta, Google, Salesforce, and many more. So it's really great to have you on the show today, Melissa.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Great, great, great. Today, we're going to talk about a bit how you can bake innovation into your company culture and stuff like that. And as preparation for our talk, I watched some videos of yours, and you stated several times that innovation starts with the way you think about yourself. So that's a really important topic. If you want to start with innovation in your company as well. And yeah, this brings me already to my first question. So how do you think about yourself? What gets you up in the morning?
I love this question. So really what gets me up in the morning is making a difference. And the way that I love to make a difference is seeing that the light in people's eyes when they have made some kind of a shift in themselves. And the favorite shift that I love to make in people is when they transition from, I don't think I'm very creative, to, oh my gosh, I am creative. That's my favorite shift that I love to make. And one of the reasons why I'm so passionate about that, Thomas, is because I used to believe that I was a non-creative person for several years, for about 15 years. I really believed that I was a non-creative person. Nobody believes that about me because I have so many different ways of expressing myself creatively now. And I was really miserable for those 15 years. Have you ever seen the film The Wizard of Oz?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Wizard of Oz also in the UX area. So like a metaphor, which is known quite well. Yes, of course. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a, you know, very classic movie that starts out in black and white. And in the time when it was originally introduced, Technicolor, this you know, new innovation, right, of color on film was so exciting and new. And so there's this whole first section of the film where everything's black and white. And then Dorothy gets swept up in the tornado. And then she opens the door of the house that she's swept up in, and everything's in Technicolor. And that was what my life felt like when I came back to my native creativity. And all of us, when we're born, every human being on the planet, we are creative beings. And how that gets expressed is, you know, there's a whole spectrum of ways that we can express ourselves creatively. Really, it comes down to we have the ability to solve problems, whether those problems come in the form of, you know, watercolors on paper, or whether that they come in the form of code or, you know, mathematics or something. It doesn't matter. But we all have that ability, that innate human ability of creativity, but it gets quashed really, really early. So when I see people reclaiming that sense of themselves as creative beings, it's just nothing makes me happier, because that's something that I felt so deeply myself.
That's really interesting. There's an artist here in Germany, Josef Beuys, he's called. And he also had this motto, everybody is an artist in the end. And so yeah. It sounds like you think it was something, so your creativity was something which was also, which was already part of yourself, but somehow covered. And how did you manage then to uncover?
Yeah, well, it's kind of a long, windy road, but I, you know, not everybody feels necessarily a deep connection to, say, artistic pursuits like I did when I was a child. I was definitely always drawn to the table in kindergarten that had all the markers and the crayons. That was something I was drawn to. And I loved to dance and sing and all of the sort of traditional artistic, quote unquote, creative pursuits. So things that we label as the creative things, right? Of course, I will put a stake in the ground and say that there are lots of many, many, many other ways of being creative, but those are the things that we label as creative. And I was very drawn to those. But as early as first grade, I started comparing my work to other people's work, which is a natural thing. We all start to notice differences when we're young, but I started comparing my own work negatively pretty early on. I remember there was a kid in my class named Aaron, and he drew these amazing race cars in first grade, and I thought they were so good. They looked so realistic, you know, for a first grader. And I didn't feel like I could draw as realistically as he did. Now, I didn't have any desire to draw race cars, but still, because he could draw these realistic race cars, and I didn't feel like my drawing skills were, they weren't the same. They were my, you know, everybody's different, right? But I had this little gremlin inside my head that put this, you know, judgment on my own drawing abilities. And from there on, it just got worse and worse and worse until I was 13 and I was in an adult drawing class, actually. I had always got sort of put in these after school classes for quote unquote gifted and talented kids. And I remember being in this adult drawing class, and we were given this assignment to go outside and pick a tree and draw from the roots all the way out to the branches with a new stroke, you know, for each branch. And I just couldn't make, I just felt like whatever was coming out of my fingers was not matching what I was seeing on the tree that I was looking at, where all these adults that were drawing these trees were making these incredible drawings that looked so realistic. And I just felt like, this is it. I'm incapable of doing this. And instead of using what I now know is a growth mindset, instead of looking at what I was doing and saying, well, this is something I could learn and get better at, instead I shut it down. And I said, well, I just suck at drawing and that's it. I'm not an artist. I'm not creative. And I gave up on art and I stopped drawing for 15 years. I stopped making art. And, you know, I did the same thing with music. I gave up playing instruments a couple of years after that. I didn't make any music for 15 years. And I didn't come back to it until I was in my late 20s. For some reason, I was able to come back to it then and just sort of kind of fell backwards into it. I was actually procrastinating doing the, you know, what I was quote unquote supposed to be doing at the time. I had decided I was going to become a writer. But when, you know, amazing, brilliant prose didn't flow instantaneously from my fingertips, I found it very easy to procrastinate doing the writing. And so I started doing these other little side projects, these little arts and crafts things. I didn't think of them as art. They were just sort of playing around. So here's the thing. The pressure was very low. It was non-existent because I was just letting myself make crap. I was trying things. I was experimenting. And as a result, I just kept doing it. I would put a lot of time into these, you know, these little playful experiments. And I ended up following that because there was no pressure. It was easy. It was fun. And then I was getting a lot of praise for what I was creating. And that ended up becoming my business. That's what I ended up doing for 15 years.
Yeah. So now you use all your experience that you made with your own creativity, also then to help like teams for innovation processes and stuff like that, and also communicate better. And so how do you, or what challenges do you actually see when you work with the teams and companies you work with, especially in the UX or design area, maybe?
Yeah, I love this question. So I work in what I refer to as the three C's, which are really required. It's really the intersection of these three C's that is the foundation for breakthroughs and innovation. And the three C's are connection, communication, and creativity. And without these three C's, it is really, really hard in an organizational structure for breakthroughs and innovation to happen. Everything I do, connection is baked in. You can't hire me and not get connection, because that is just baked into everything. One of the biggest challenges that organizations, teams, and companies have when they bring me in has to do with communication. And particularly with UX teams, I see a number of communication challenges that consistently hold them back. One thing that I see a lot of is the expertise paradox. So UX professionals are deeply knowledgeable in their domain, but that expertise can actually become a barrier when communicating with non-UX stakeholders, because they're swimming in this terminology and in concepts that seem really obvious to them, but might be completely foreign to others. And I call this, I'm not the only one who calls it this, I call it the curse of knowledge or the curse of expertise. It's really hard to remember what it was like not to know what you know. So that's the first thing. Another challenge that I see is the empathy gap. Now, UX designers are trained really well to empathize with users. They have a high skill in that, but they sometimes struggle to apply the same empathy to their internal stakeholders. Understanding the pressures and the priorities and the perspectives of product managers and developers or executives, that is just as important as understanding users if you want your designs to actually get implemented. So that's another challenge that I am often called in to help with. And then third, there's what I call the presentation perfectionism trap. UX professionals, I see you nodding. So UX professionals often feel that they need really polished presentations in order to be taken seriously, which can lead to delays in sharing early concepts. And that's when the feedback would be most valuable. And this creates a cycle where work is done in isolation way too long and stakeholders aren't brought along the journey. And then there's this resistance when the ta-da moment finally comes. So those are a few challenges that around communication that are holding, that I see holding UX teams back.
I think, so in my experience, those challenges are all also interconnected to each other. So as we as UX people, as you say, we are very, very knowledgeable in our area of expertise, and we tend to think what we see must be clear to everybody else as well. So it fully resonates with me what you say, that sometimes for us it's really hard to understand that somebody else just does not see what we see as a problem or a challenge in whatever product we are working on. And then when we talk about our insights, I also made the experience that it might be intimidating for others as well, because maybe we use technical terms not everybody's familiar with. And yes, this really destroys this connection probably that you mentioned in the beginning. Yeah. So what I understand is now you help the teams to get better communicators and to spread their insights into the organizations and also communicate with non-UX people and especially non-researchers. That's also something I realized a lot. If you talk to people who are fresh from university or just had their degrees a couple of years ago, they are very much focused on numbers and scientific evidence and stuff like that. But that's sometimes not really so helpful because it might get quite complicated easily. So how do you help them to overcome these challenges?
Yeah, absolutely. Before I get into that, I also want to bring in a couple of other specific issues that I have worked with UX researchers on, is because they come from academic backgrounds and they're so highly, have been so highly immersed in these academic backgrounds. Another issue that I see is they're so used to arguing their point from that academic perspective that they dig in their heels and they argue their point, which is not actually an effective way to get their point across in this different setting. So getting a point across in an academic setting is one thing, but getting a point across in a corporate setting is totally different. So in that case, you want to actually win people over, not dig your heels in and argue. So one of the ways that I help with these teams of UX researchers, and actually this is a technique that I teach pretty much everywhere I go, is helping people establish a yes and mindset right off the bat. So if listeners are familiar with this concept from the world of improv, this yes and mindset is, it doesn't mean that you agree. It means that you accept ideas and build on those ideas. Now, this is really hard for a lot of people to sort of wrap their heads around, especially if you are a gatekeeper, if your job is to be a gatekeeper, because it often is hard to tease out that the difference between a yes and mindset and just opening the gates and letting everything in and saying, okay, now we're going to actually implement your idea. It doesn't mean that you're actually going to implement the idea, but it means you're going to validate people's ideas when they bring them forward instead of dismissing and blocking them. Here's what happens if you dismiss and block somebody's idea, guess what they're going to do next time they have an idea? They're not going to bring it to you. So one of the first things that I do when I come in and work with a team is I have them, I put them into small groups where they get to plan a party together. And we, guess what? The organization has given you an unlimited budget to plan this party, and they get to determine what the theme of the party is. And they have a lot of fun figuring, you know, deciding on what the theme is. And then they go around in their small party planning committee, and each person presents an idea of what they want this party to, you know, have. Maybe it's going to be, you know, I wanted to have pizza. I wanted to have a band, you know, what they can do whatever they want. It's unlimited budget, right? And each person after them says, yes, and they accept and build on that, right? So they get to experience that. Then we get to do that again. But the next time we do it, instead of yes, and same prompt, it's a new party, new unlimited budget. But this time they say yes, but. So they get to experience the difference between accepting and building on people's ideas and what happens if you say yes, but, which is basically no in a party dress. So then we get to talk about what was the difference with those two experiences. What happened? What was the party like? What was it? What did it feel like? What did it feel like to block or dismiss somebody's idea? What did it feel like to have your idea blocked and dismissed? And, you know, how did the parties, you know, one party kind of got, you know, big and exciting and wild, and the other party didn't really go anywhere. The party planning experience didn't really go anywhere. So we get to see them side by side, and they get to experience that. So then, you know, I'm always, whenever I do these programs with the teams that I work with, it's not just a one-shot deal. I come in over several weeks and work with them. So they have this experience of this yes and mindset. We talk about it all throughout the, you know, the several weeks that I work with them, and they start to really build that muscle of this yes and, you know, attitude and philosophy, and it changes the culture. So that's the first thing. Then for the expertise paradox, one of the things I really love to do is we use an exercise called Time Traveler, where I pair people up and one person is from the present time, that everything is normal for them, and their partner is a time traveler from 500 years ago, and they have to explain a modern device, like their cell phone, for example, to their time traveling partner. And they only have about 2 minutes to do that. But here's the thing. First, before I send them off into their partners, we talk about how life was different the time traveler, what actually would life have been like for somebody in the year 1525. No electricity, no running water, no automobiles, whatever, you know, they bubble up all the things that they can think of. And then imagine somebody shows up with, for example, a cell phone or something. That time traveler is going to think you're a witch. There's a high likelihood they're going to want to, you know, condemn you to burn at the stake, right? So you're going to have to convince them not to condemn you to burn at the stake while you're still trying to explain what this device is. So how are you going to do that? So then they have 2 minutes for this exercise, which is an impossible exercise. There's a lot of laughter in the room or in their breakout rooms if we're on a Zoom call. They come back into the main room. They come back together. And I ask them, all right, how many witches are in the room? Invariably, half the room raises their hand because it's an impossible exercise. But then I pull the time travelers and ask them, did anybody, any of your partners do something that was effective? And so we talk about that. And invariably, whoever did something that was effective, what it came down to was they found a common point of connection and they used an analogy. So then knowing that, I have them switch roles. I give them a different, slightly different, you know, scenario, and I send them off again. And so now the partner who is the present time partner for this round has a bit of a leg up because now they know, okay, I'm going to have to find a common point of connection and I'm going to have to figure out an analogy that my partner's going to relate to. Well, this has, you know, they're not going to, the likelihood that they're actually going to run into somebody from 500 years ago in their day-to-day life is pretty slim, but the probability that they're going to run into somebody who has a different context from their own is about 100%. So they go out into their work and their lives, talking to their spouses, talking to their kids, talking to their, you know, cross-functional teammates. And this has immediate applications. And I get response all the time from people who tell me stories about how, you know, they think about this. Oh my gosh, I'm the witch.
Yeah, so two questions I have in my mind. So you said, how long does it take actually to overcome such habits? For example, saying yes, but, and things like that. So you said it's not a one-shot exercise and then everything is working properly. So I think it takes really a while until you can train and strengthen your muscles. Like you would also go to the gym not only one time, yeah, and then you're fit and stuff. So you have to practice regularly, I guess. So that's the first question. How long does it take to your experience to really transition from this yes but to this yes and way of communicating? And second, then you said you also do Zoom calls. So does this also work online, or is it easier when being in the room with the other people? So, yeah. What's your experience there?
Yeah. So I'll answer the second question, mm-hmm, first. I actually developed my Communicating for Influence and Impact program originally as a virtual, fully virtual program. I developed it during the pandemic. It was 2020 to 2021. The original cohort was a research team at Facebook. And then that manager was so thrilled with the outcome that she referred me to a whole bunch of other research teams inside of Facebook. So, and I've lost count of how many research teams at now Meta I've worked with. And those have all been virtual. So, but I actually really love working in person when I get the opportunity. So all of the activities that I designed this program with can be done either virtually or in person.
That's great. That's great for you.
Yeah. And as far as how long it takes, you know, your analogy of going to a gym is very apt, because what I do when I work with teams around these kinds of challenges is I'm helping to build muscles, essentially metaphorical muscles. And the most savvy organizations that bring me in for a long period of time, rather than, you know, yes, I can help you identify muscles if you bring me in for a shorter time period, but you're going to get the most results, the best results, the longest lasting results if you bring me in and work with your organization, you know, for a year or more. But, you know, companies are going to do what they're going to do. But it is like going to a gym. I can help you if you bring me in for, you know, one or two workshops or whatever, then I'm going to help you identify the muscles. And then it's up to you to keep at it. Because just like going to the gym, you go once, you're going to maybe be sore the next day, but that muscle's not going to, it's not going to persist.
Yeah, but you may have realized that you have muscles at a place where you didn't even know. So that's maybe also something organizations, yes, need to learn first, or teams need to learn first, which muscles actually they need to train. So I guess, yeah, there are many blind spots in many teams, also related to what we call the company culture and stuff like that. And yeah.
Yeah. So the first thing that happens when I come in and I do these activities with teams is I'm basically lighting up light bulbs over their heads. You know, there are lots of aha moments, insights are firing, and that's a huge value. And then the next step is for them to make sure that the insights that they had, the light bulbs that went off, become, you know, implemented and become part of the culture. And that's where the, you know, the going to the gym metaphor comes in, because it is, it needs to become habit and part of how you do things.
So now when the teams trained the way they communicate, so how would this help them then in the end to also, transition the whole organization to the next level of UX maturity, for example? I mean, I discussed this topic of UX maturity already in other episodes, and you can, that's also a questionable, metaphor, but the idea of, driving also the organization to a more user-centered way of developing technology, I think that's a common ground we can agree to. So how would then the teams that learned and they have their muscles strengthened, how can they use those to actually also level the organization up a bit to become more user-centered, for example?
Yeah. Well, in an ideal world, it wouldn't just be the UX team that is building all of these skills and muscles and learning the whole concept of yes and, you know, all of these skills for empathy and listening and the skills that I'm teaching. It wouldn't just be the UX team in, you know, an island in the middle of an organization that's completely blind to all of these skills. It would be the whole organization. That's an ideal world. We obviously don't always live in an ideal world. But when any team is improving their ability to communicate for greater impact and influence, it's going to have a ripple effect. So the UX team now has the ability to, you know, whoever is approaching them with their ideas, their whatever they're coming to the UX team with, and the UX team members are able to respond with this yes and mindset, whoever is approaching them now, they, instead of feeling blocked, instead of feeling dismissed, they're going to have a positive response. So that's going to ripple out. Then in addition, whenever the UX team is sharing their brilliant insights, their ideas, they now know how to communicate them. So those insights are going to spread more readily throughout the organization. And that's just a couple of examples. You know, I haven't even talked about how I help them break down their perfectionism and other areas. So just so many different, multiple different ways in which I'm helping the UX team to communicate more effectively and also to unlock their creativity, if we're working on that as well, which is going to ripple out in their relationships with their cross-functional teammates and with leadership, which is just going to make a big difference throughout the organization.
Yeah, and I think especially from a leadership perspective, it's also quite helpful then that you realize that the UX team is not blocking or asking just for more resources and more time, but they also can help you as a leader to solve actually your problems as well. And that's the important connection, I think, which needs to be done.
Yeah. And I think the magic is going to happen also when UX professionals stop seeing communication as a separate skill and start treating it as part of their design process. They're essentially designing the experience of how others understand their work.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, shall we dive in a bit more into the details and talk about some of the exercises you have in your in your portfolio?
Sure, sure. So do you want to talk more about my framework or some example exercises, some additional example exercises?
Yes, I personally always am interested in practical examples that people also might want to use and try out for themselves maybe first. And then, so some really practical tips, that would be great.
Okay. Okay. So, Some of my favorite exercises that work really well with UX teams. Are you willing to maybe play some with
me? Yes, why not? Let's try.
Okay.
My inner critic says, I hope I'm doing good.
So let me think of one that I think this one will work well in audio only. We'll just invite people who are listening to use their imaginative skills. So I'm going to invite you, Thomas, to imagine that I am presenting you with a gift. I'm giving you a gift. I'm handing it to you with my hands, and you're going to take the gift and tell me what it is and what you love about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So
here's the gift.
Thank you very much for this amazing gift. I like how the box is wrapped. The color of the paper is really super nice. It's quite heavy, so I wonder what's inside. I would be curious to unpack the box. But first of all, of course, I would appreciate how it's wrapped and have a look at the paper you selected for this gift. And first of all, I'm really, really honored to get this gift from you. And I wonder what I did to deserve it, and so on and so forth. So yeah, that's what came up to my mind right now.
Perfect. That's great. Okay, and now you can hand me a gift.
So here's my gift for you.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much. It's a cupcake and it's gluten-free. You knew exactly what I wanted because I was hungry and I was just longing for something sweet, but you knew that I only eat gluten-free. So thank you so much. I'm going to put it over here because I obviously can't eat right now during the podcast, but I will have it as soon as we're done recording. Thank you so much. Okay, so that is an example of gift giving. Another way that I like to do it is I would hand you a gift and tell you what the gift is. So let's do that. So I'm going to tell you what the gift is, and then you're going to add a little detail to the gift. Maybe, you know, add something that I didn't tell you about it. Maybe a certain kind of a color or some kind of a detail to it, and, you know, and thank me for it. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So Thomas, here is a new podcasting microphone.
Wow. That's really awesome. I was looking for such a nice microphone with this extra pop stopper in front of it. I always wanted to have a microphone which is not just black, it's boring. So this blue one is really amazing. Yeah, and so on and so forth.
Great, great. Yeah. Okay, now hand me a gift.
Here, Melissa, is a new ukulele for you.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. And it's pink. I have a turquoise ukulele. Now I have a pink one. I love it. So now I have two different ones. And this one has a low G string. So now I've always wanted a ukulele with a low G string. Thank you so much, Thomas. What a fantastic gift. Okay. So this is gift giving. And we can go back and forth with this for, you know, a few minutes. And this is practicing. We can, you know, debrief on this, but, you know, there's lots of things happening here. We're practicing imagination. We're practicing thinking on our feet. There's lots of different skills that we're practicing here, and we're practicing positivity. Okay. So now the next step on this is a version of I have lots of different variations on this, but we're going to do one that I'm calling terrible gifts. So now I'm going to give you a gift that is something I would never, ever give anyone. And your job is to find the good in it. Find something positive in this gift. Why? First, you're going to thank me for it. And then you're going to tell me why this is such a good gift.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So Thomas, I have for you a rotten, crumbling sandwich.
Oh, thank you so much for this smelling experience that you provided to me. It reminds me of that everything in the world is in process, and looks different the other day. If you just wait, then things transition into another format. And so thank you very much for this special experience.
Excellent. Great. Okay, now give me a terrible gift.
Oh, a terrible gift. A terrible gift. Here, Melissa, here are some old broken shoes I have for you, which I would really love to see you wearing for your next dinner party, for example.
Oh my goodness, thank you so much for these old broken shoes. You know what I'd really love to do with these? I have this vision for my back garden of creating a shoe wall with shoes that are like old broken shoes filled with flowers. So these will be an incredible addition. I've been wondering where I could find some old broken shoes to fill with flowers for my vision of an artistic shoe flower wall for my garden. Thank you so much, Thomas. This is fantastic. You're really helping me manifest my vision. Okay, so that is an example, and we could go back and forth with these terrible gifts and keep coming up with reasons why something terrible is actually something really good. And this is a great way, you know, then after we would do this, then I would come back and ask people, you know, why do you think we did this?
Good question. So what I realized in the beginning, I had quite abstract thoughts in my mind, mm-hmm. but yeah, as we did it two or three times, so my imagination got more concrete, and also you had definitely some concrete thoughts that you shared about the gifts that I gave to you. Yeah, so it's getting, and probably I was more able to let just my thoughts flow without thinking too much. And I think that's also an important topic. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. So how often are we in a meeting or some sort of situation with other people and something goes wrong or somebody tells us to do something or, you know, things don't happen the way we want them to happen or the way we expect them to happen? Now what?
Mm-hmm.
How often does that happen?
Quite often, of course.
Frequently, yeah. Right? So what are we going to do with that? That is basically a terrible gift mm-hmm. that we've been given. And we have to somehow you know, we have a choice. We can say, well, I'm screwed. Or we can choose to find a way to transform it. And one of the gifts of improv is that it gives us an opportunity to flex that muscle. Mm-hmm. And so this is it's a little improv game that helps us flex that muscle. And you did a phenomenal job.
Thank you.
And this is a human skill. This is our, you know, this is our creativity at work. Our brains will always figure it out. Mm-hmm. We just have to trust that we know what to do and just let our brains figure it out for us without stressing. So
yeah, and I think the main take-home message is you can train it. You can train it.
Yes.
And yeah, that's really an amazing story because yeah, you're not lost, but you can learn how to train this muscle. It's really great.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I love about improv and most of the activities that I do with the teams that I work with come from the world of improv. And I am always recommending that people take improv classes for that very reason, because it's like a gym for leadership skills and listening skills and, you know, communication skills and all of those skills that are going to make us more effective at life, really. Yeah.
But one thing I guess is really crucial which is trust in the team. So
yes.
you really have to trust your teammates. Because you show something of yourself, and I think in an insecure environment, this is not possible.
Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. That's why, as I said, the first of my three C's is connection, and embedded in the connection is that trust. That is why the connection is such a key piece, because without the trust, you know, it's foundational. Absolutely. Mm.
All right, great. Yeah, this was really fun. So shall we briefly also talk about your book, or maybe how could people work with you? So what else you would like to share?
Sure. Yeah, my book is called The Creative Sandbox Way. And I wrote this book as really as a gift to that former self of mine, mm-hmm. my former self that believed that I wasn't creative, that it's actually aimed at three former selves, three avatars. One is the person who believes I'm not creative. A second avatar is the person who knows they're creative, but is never getting to their creative thing because, you know, I just don't have time or whatever. I've also been that person. And the third is the professional creative who got into doing their creative profession because they love, you know, making art or writing or music or whatever it is, but now they're doing it professionally and they're never doing it for joy. And I've been that person. So I wrote the book to help get past creative block, help other people get past creative block. It took me a long time to figure out what the key was for myself. And I developed a framework, which is basically 10 guideposts that I came up with in order to get myself out of creative stuck. And so the book is written around the 10 guideposts are the scaffolding of the book, basically.
So
it's really a structured approach to that walks people through these 10 guideposts. And it's designed, the book is only available in hard copy because it's designed for the reader to write and draw and doodle in the actual book. However, for your listeners, I do have a link where you can go and download the first 50 pages for free just to get a taste of it.
Super nice.
And, yeah. So that link is bit.ly/leadUX thank you, all lowercase.
Yes, I'll put it in the show notes, definitely, so everybody can find it there then. That's great. So, and this book is dedicated to individuals. So you would work on your own, or is it also for team work?
It is written towards individuals, but at the back, I do have a section that talks about how you can work through it as like a book group or as a team. It was when I wrote it, I aimed it at this is before I pivoted to work for organizations. So the audience that I was writing to when I wrote the book was individual creatives. The principles in the book are global principles. So they definitely apply for UX teams, for tech leaders, for, you know, they apply globally. And it's particularly powerful for UX teams because it addresses the root causes of creative blocks that prevent breakthrough innovation. And some of the guideposts are especially transformative for UX teams. First, there is no wrong. That is guidepost number one. And that creates psychological safety that's essential for innovation. And in UX, of course, we're often trying to find the right solution. But that pressure can actually inhibit creative thinking. And when teams embrace that there's no wrong way to start exploring a problem, they generate more diverse ideas and they ultimately reach better solutions. And then second, think process, not product. That's guidepost number two. And UX designers, of course, are naturally outcome focused. They want to create these amazing user experiences, which, you know, obviously, of course, but sometimes that focus on the end result can create tunnel vision. And when teams shift attention to enjoying the design process itself, they become more open to unexpected discoveries along the way. And then third, the last guidepost that I think is especially relevant to UX teams is spring the comparison trap. And this one is huge for UX teams who are constantly looking at competitors and industry best practices. And while that research is valuable, it can lead to kind of homogenized design if teams get caught up in comparing their work to others. And learning to appreciate your team's unique perspective and unique approach really frees you to create truly differentiated experiences. And what makes this framework so effective is that it doesn't just address surface level creativity techniques, it tackles the deeper mindset shifts that allow sustained innovation to flourish.
Wow, great. Yeah, sounds really fascinating. And yeah, as I said, we'll put the link in the show notes, and then people can have a look and experience it firsthand. And now if they get interested in, if our listeners would like to work with you, you said you also do online, or actually you started many of your, or some of your work already as online sessions. So how would it be possible also for somebody not living in California to work with you?
Yeah, absolutely. You can find me at my website, which is my name, melissadinwiddie.com. You can also find me on LinkedIn at Melissa Dinwiddie over there. And you can find me on my YouTube channel, also Melissa Dinwiddie. And you can find me on Instagram as well. I'm not super active there these days, but I do post about once a week on Instagram right now. And breaking the pattern on Instagram, I am @a_creative_life. So a creative life with underscores in between.
Great. Yeah, we can also, of course, put this in the show notes for everybody to make it easy to find. And yeah, Melissa, it was really fun. So I would love to do more of those exercises. And I am pretty sure tomorrow morning somebody in the office will be surprised about some exercises I will bring in.
Oh, good. Do you have to tell me how it goes?
Yeah, definitely. I will. Yeah, so great. Thanks for your time. Maybe some final advice for upcoming leaders, what to focus on in this, also tough times, of course, but what would be your outlook or your final advice to our aspiring leaders amongst the listeners?
Well, I just reassert to everyone that creativity isn't a talent, it's a skill. And the best companies engineer it. So I would, say that. And we didn't really talk so much about this, but innovation dies in a culture of fear. And if failure isn't an option, neither is success. So that's something for people to think about as well.
Great. Yeah, super important. I think so too. And thanks again for your time and sharing your experiences. It was really fun. And thanks again. It was really great to have you on the show today.
Thank you, Thomas. Thanks so much for having me. This has been a blast.
Now, thanks everyone for listening. And of course, we'd love to receive your feedback and positive reviews on your podcast platform of choice. Thanks for listening and have fun getting creative.